From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, a weird twist in the Flint water crisis. Then, our commentators on a Republican plan limiting environmental protections in Michigan to federal levels.
In this case, they want to defer to the federal government, which is totally antithetical to historical Republican philosophy.
Could the Democrats end up with all women running for the top offices?
If it turns out that it's all white women, hey, you know, can you win?
The story behind an art collection gift to the University of Michigan.
And he said, is there a way that we could figure out how the Inuit can make some money by doing Inuit-type things rather than white man-type things? And my father looked up and he said, oh, hell yes, this is easy.
And we've got a cocktail that cures what ails you.
This is Tammy's Cure-All.
Restorative properties not confirmed. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Two members of Congress, Republican Fred Upton and Democrat Debbie Dingell, are co-chairing a working group that's tackling the topics of school shootings and other gun issues. Representative Dingell joins us now. Welcome.
It's good to be with you, Lester.
You were quoted as saying, let's not have the same old discussion on guns. How are you approaching the discussion this time?
I'm trying to find where the common ground is. If we have the same old discussion, everybody goes to their corner, we don't make any progress. That's what's happened every time there's been a shooting. Every time the subject of guns has come up, people who can make a difference don't talk to each other. People don't move anything. So we have a group that is equally divided between Republicans and Democrats. And Fred Upton and I are leading the group, and Fred and I have met with everybody. We have met with the students and the teachers, prosecutors, judges, members of the ACLU, mental health experts, everybody that's got a stake in this game.
Are you talking to gun groups as well?
I am talking to people that are gun groups. I'm talking to gun owners. And just for the record, I'm married to probably one of the strongest protectors of the Second Amendment in this country. And this is an issue that we have strongly disagreed on because we come to it from different perspectives. His father taught him as a boy about hunting and fishing. I had a father who shouldn't have had access to guns. So none of us wants to see any child go to school and be afraid of what's going to happen to them at school. Nor should people be going to churches or to movie theaters and afraid of what's going to happen. So the question is, how do we keep our schools safer? How do we keep our communities safer? Are there certain things that we can do that make it safer? And that's what I'm trying to figure out. And then when we do reach some common ground, how do we actually get it moved through the Congress?
You mentioned your father. You appeared on CNN not too long ago, and during an interview, you said, my father shouldn't have had a gun. What's the story behind that?
Well, my father had a drug addiction, and when his moods would snap, there were guns in the house. We know that this is a problem with domestic abuse, that if there's a gun in the situation, there's a much higher likelihood of an outcome of violence or potential death. I actually had to get in between my parents and keep him from shooting a gun. I have hidden in a closet, scared to death about what was going to happen, afraid that we wouldn't make it with my brothers and sisters, praying to God, let us survive the night. So I do believe that family members and law enforcement need to have a tool that if someone is deemed a threat to themselves or to the community, that the gun can be taken away with due process there to protect them. And I also believe that if someone's been and I have one of the few bipartisan bills that's been in the Congress for a couple of years that would say if someone had been convicted of a domestic abuse, a convicted felon using a gun, that they not be able to have a gun.
As you know, there were rallies all around the nation regarding guns and school safety. What kind of impact are these marches and rallies by young people, such as the Parkland students, having on the members of Congress who are instrumental in making any possible changes?
You know, I think that our young people are 25% of our population and 100% of our future. And I think I've said this to the adults. We need to get out of the way and let them be our voice. One of the reasons everybody says the NRA is powerful because they have money, and I'm not diminishing the amount of their contributions, but I don't really think that that's why they impact the process. They impact the process because people who are NRA members are single-issue voters. they're afraid that someone's trying to take away their gun, which, by the way, we're not trying to, I'm certainly not trying to repeal the Second Amendment. I'm trying to make sure that if someone shouldn't have access to a gun, they not have access to a gun. But if these young people register to vote, if they're people in the communities that think some common sense tools like making sure if someone's a threat to themselves, a gun can be taken away, turn out and vote, then you're going to see a difference, I think, in whether people are willing to act.
You mentioned the so-called red flag law. What kind of meaningful bipartisan legislation has a chance in Congress? Making schools more safe, mental health, background checks, restriction on access. What's really under consideration?
So little things have already happened that people didn't realize. So when I was at the Ann Arbor March, people were saying that part of what the Parkland students also wanted was to allow the CDC to do research on gun violence, which is something that we should have done a long time ago. That was actually included in the omnibus, as was the NICS fix, which begins to ensure that the data being entered is being entered, the data that we need for the background check system when people are buying guns. Unfortunately, we need to expand the background check. And I do believe that a majority of people in the Congress support it, but we have to encourage leadership to be willing to bring that forward. Also, with the Safe Schools Act was included in the omnibus that passed last week, which will give grants to local communities to make their schools safer. And I think that belongs at the local level, because that's where you know what you need to do from a community perspective to ensure that your schools are safe. But we do need to. We will, Fred and I will be introducing with Susan Brooks a red flag bill that actually was passed in Indiana. It will be a version of the Indiana legislation that Vice President Pence, Governor Mitch Daniels supports. They're conservatives. Indiana is a conservative state, and they've used this law more than 800 times already. I am hopeful with the kind of Republican support that we see there that we can get that through. I'm having a lot of success in talking to people about domestic violence. And quite frankly, there really is general consensus on the bump stock. So we just need to figure out how to get that on a moving bill and get a bill introduced to ban the bump stock.
When you mentioned that people go to their corners and they stand in their positions, I'm wondering, when you hear a former justice of the Supreme Court and activists say we need to repeal the Second Amendment, how helpful is that in finding some kind of compromise?
Well, quite frankly, it wasn't helpful. And a lot of people have used that to say that, you know, we want to ban all guns in this country. And I know that there are people that do want to ban all guns. I just want to make it safe for people in the community. Hunting and fishing has been an important part of American culture, and there are many people in this country who have learned to do it from generation to generation. But there are people that shouldn't have access to guns, such as my father. We do know that we have an escalating incidence of gun violence in this country, so how do we take some common sense solutions that keep people safe, but, you know, still protect the Second Amendment?
Debbie Dingell represents Michigan's 12th Congressional District. She, along with Fred Upton, are co-chairing the Working Group on Response to the Parkland Shooting, which is part of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you.
As it stands right now, the likely Democratic nominee for United States Senate is three-time Senator Debbie Stabenow. Gretchen Whitmer is getting endorsements from leading Democrats in her pursuit of the nomination for governor. Jocelyn Benson is running unopposed for the Democratic nomination for Secretary of State. And in the Democrats' contest for Attorney General nominee, there's also a woman, as well as two African-American men. Dana Nessel is a former prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney. She's probably most famous for her efforts to get gay marriage legalized in the U.S. She's also the first openly gay candidate running for statewide office in Michigan. She expected some pushback because of that, but she says she's getting more pushback because of her nomination. Her nomination would likely mean a Democratic slate of all white women.
What stunned me was the fact that people found much more problematic the fact that I was a woman. And frankly, I've been so obsessed with homophobia for many years, I completely forgot to worry about sexism.
Nestle says this concern about an all-woman slate of Democrats bothers her a lot. She notes when she attended the state Democratic convention in 2014 and all the nominations were men, no one seemed to have an issue with that. All of those men lost in the general election. William Noakes is also seeking the Democratic nomination for attorney general. He's an attorney, a professor, and a minister. He's worked as a lawyer in the private sector and the public sector. He's African-American and a man. He says he believes he's the best qualified, that he can win, and he hopes his fellow Democrats agree. But if the nominee is a woman, that's not an important issue to him.
What means a lot to me is how good are you, and are you capable of winning in November? And that's going to be the real issue.
Noakes says the party should be more concerned about the quality of the candidate rather than race or gender.
I don't think much of that issue at all. If it turns out that it's all white women, hey, you know, can you win? If it turns out that it's not, can you win? That's what it comes down to.
A third candidate running for the Democratic Party's nomination for attorney general is Pat Miles, former U.S. attorney in Michigan's Western District, also male, also African-American. And when asked about the pushback within the party about an all-female slate and the desire to have at least one person of color on the statewide Democratic ticket, Miles was diplomatic.
The Democratic Party is a party of diversity and inclusion, and it always has tried to make sure that the ticket represents the state as a whole, and I think that's an appropriate thing to do, to make sure that the ticket represents the entire state.
Asked if he would support a slate of all white women.
I will always support the Democratic ticket. No doubt about that.
Dana Nessel made one other point about her candidacy for attorney general.
I'm certainly not suggesting that people should vote for me only because I'm a woman. They should look at my policies. They should look at my experience. They should look at my grit and my determination to do what's right in this office. But if all those things are in place, I certainly shouldn't be discounted or disregarded only because I'm a woman.
Things could change. There's an upcoming endorsement convention, a filing deadline, and the state Democratic Party nominating convention. And through all of it, Democrats will wrestle with the question of whether women candidates will face bias or whether they'll do better than the men in the era of hashtag Me Too. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's turn to our regular Friday commentators, Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. He joins us by Skype. And Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. The League of Conservation Voters recently issued a blog about what the group calls five bad ideas for Michigan. And I wanted to go quickly through those five to hear what you think of them. Number one, a couple of bills that would turn final authority for environmental rulemaking and permit decisions to politically appointed boards. Ken, does the Department of Environmental Quality need a check like that?
There's no problem in having a check on department decisions, whether it's rules or permits. I think the issue here is that these review boards currently structured in the legislature are stacked unfairly on industry side. And that's just not an appropriate way to approach environmental protection.
Vicki, what do you think of an unelected board making final environmental decisions for the state?
I don't have a problem with an unelected board making some decisions or being advisory. However, as Ken said, these boards would increase the bureaucracy of the state of Michigan, take power actually away from the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, and allow industry insiders to be appointed. In fact, they specifically say who should be appointed, including lobbyists, to some of these boards. And that's where I have a problem.
Let's look at the second package of legislation. This is a bill that would let private companies and farms withdraw greater amounts of water without regard to the impact to wetlands or streams. Think of big irrigation operations or Nestle. Ken, the Farm Bureau really wants this. What do you think of it?
There's a flashpoint down in southwest Michigan, particularly Cass County, where large farmers are running into problems procedurally, not getting decisions from the DEQ in time. So large-scale water withdrawal should be based on scientific knowledge, what's going on, what's happening to streams, lakes, rivers. And I think in this case, it's not something the legislature should really decide. I think a panel of experts ought to be allowed to weigh in, and we have that panel, and I think it ought to be utilized.
Vicki, we're a water-rich state. Would pumping groundwater really affect these streams and wetlands?
Yes. Draining them would certainly affect them. It would drain them. But we also have a Great Lakes Water Compact with the Great Lakes states and two provinces of Canada. And that is basically a treaty type of compact that's been worked out, and it requires the use of a water withdrawal tool. So this would circumvent that and would allow Michigan's industry to withdraw way too much water without using the tool. So it's very, very much a problem.
Let's go to the third bill here. Michigan has stricter ballast water pollution standards in an effort to keep invasive species out of the Great Lakes. And ballast water is the water that's held in the bottom of a cargo ship to keep it balanced. A bill would roll back the standards in Michigan to the ones set by the U.S. Coast Guard. Ken, what effect would that have?
The irony of this bill is that it's being proposed, if you will, by Republican legislators. The irony is that in this case, they want to defer to the federal government, which is totally antithetical to historical Republican philosophy. Republicans want states to have more control. So I think that's the great irony of this particular bill, is let's defer to the federal government when that really isn't the approach Republicans normally take. And I think, frankly, Michigan's ballast water law being somewhat stronger is more appropriate for the Great Lakes state.
Vicki, does rolling back Michigan's restrictions on ballast water pollution really matter when other states aren't adhering to the same standard?
Well, that's really the problem. The problem is harmonization of laws regarding ballast water across the Great Lakes area. And Michigan can't protect the Great Lakes alone. So this would turn everything over to the Coast Guard rules, which are stricter than they used to be, but certainly not as strict as Michigan's. But Michigan's been an outlier, and the other Great Lakes states have not followed suit to require treatment of ballast water on ships before it's discharged into the Great Lakes basin. So this is an unfortunate situation. There was an amendment put on this bill by Andy Shore that would make this the new floor, so that if the federal regulations went further into deterioration, we would still stay at this level. But it's a problem for all of the Great Lakes, and I wish that they had all come around and adopted our standards, but they didn't.
Since you mentioned that, let's go to this package that would prohibit Michigan from having any regulation stronger than that of federal standards on environmental rules safeguarding public food, food safety, water, other environmental safeguards. Ken, should the state lower protections to federal standards?
Lester, this is another example of what I had just said. You know, Republicans normally would say, don't defer to the federal government. Give the states the power and the authority to make decisions that are unique to each state. And so, again, this bill is either, depending on how you view it, Republican hypocrisy, or if you're an advocate of the bill, I guess you go to the Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." But, you know, once again, I just think it's not consistent with what Republicans would normally say. Give the states the authority.
Vicki, what could possibly go wrong if we just stayed with the standards set by Washington?
Oh, so much could go wrong, Lester. We don't have the time. But let's just say that this has been put forward several times before. It has not been enacted into law, and I'm hoping that the governor would veto this should it come to his desk again. This is a bill that really would harm Michigan's ability to protect our natural resources and the safety of our citizens. The federal laws are not stringent enough in most areas.
Now, let's look at this fifth idea, or what the League of Conservation Voters calls bad ideas for Michigan. Right now, the money the state of Michigan makes from extracting oil and gas is used to pay for parks and recreation lands. This bill would allow a handful of politicians to control what's called Michigan's Natural Resources Trust Fund. Ken, is there any concern there?
Well, the Natural Resources Trust Fund is enshrined in the state constitution, and there's a process for making decisions on what lands to purchase or what recreational projects to fund. And they simply want to have more influence on which projects get funded and which lands get purchased. They can't rate it for other purposes, but they could theoretically have more impact on which projects get funded. If you ask me, do I agree it's a bad idea? Yes, I agree it's a bad idea. The fund has worked well for over 40 years, and this is one of those situations. If it ain't broke, why try to fix it?
Vicki, what's your take?
I want to point out that in 1984, the citizens of the state of Michigan voted on this. So it's very clear, and Attorney General Schuette issued an opinion in November on this very bill and said it's unconstitutional. The legislature cannot usurp the power of the trust fund board as constituted in the Constitution based on what was then Proposal B of 1984.
That's Vicki Barnett. She's a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. We've been talking about what the Michigan League of Conservation Voters calls five bad ideas for Michigan. Hey, thanks for taking a look at this.
No problem.
Thanks, Lester.
A unique collection of Inuit art is being given to the University of Michigan Museum of Art. More than 200 stone sculptures and prints are from the Inuit people on Baffin Island in Canada, just west of Greenland. The collection is valued at $2.5 million, and there are additional funds to endow an Inuit art program. These gifts are from Phil and Kathy Power. I joined Phil Power at the Center for Michigan headquarters, and I asked him before we got to the history of this collection to describe the stone sculptures for us.
A lot of them are of animals, polar bears, fish, seals, walruses. And all of that goes back to the historic origin of why Inuit people started making these carvings in the first place, because the thought was if you carve a seal, by the process of doing that, you get a better insight and understanding of how seals work and you get better success in your hunting. But as time has gone on, there are a lot of carvings of people. My wife Kathy's favorite carving is of a mother holding a baby. Not an unusual subject, but it's very tender and it's very nice. And you think, here these people are in 40 or 50 degrees below zero, and they're having the same sense of warmth and connectedness that anybody else would have. So the Inuit carvings reflect the ordinary divinity of their life in the high Arctic.
There are also prints and drawings. Are these traditional media for the Inuit?
No. Historically, people carved in walrus tusks and ivory and bone, and then also in stone. About 30 years ago, the man who had worked with the Inuits in developing their marketing for their art thought that it might be a good idea to have another medium than stone. And he went to Japan and learned how to do Japanese block printing and came back with a lot of knowledge about how to do Japanese print, a whole bunch of Japanese paper, which is important, and taught the Inuit how to make plates, in effect, out of stone and color them and pull prints from them. That led to a whole bunch of wonderful graphic artists developing. A very high percentage of Inuits do art in one way or another, both men and women. None of them trained in an art school. All of them unusually observant and characteristic of their environment.
This guy who taught them Japanese block printing.
This was done by a guy called Jim Houston, who really was the guy who pulled it together and had the idea that it could be marketed into the U.S. and the global art market.
Your Inuit art collection began because of your father, Eugene, after visiting Baffin Island. Tell us how that came about.
Well, it came about, oddly enough, through Jim Houston, whose father was an old duck hunting friend of my grandfather's. And while Jim Houston was living in Baffin Island with the Inuit, he came to the conclusion that the Inuit needed a way to make a cash income, because they needed to buy cartridges for their rifles and tea and stuff like that. And the only way at that time in the high Canadian Arctic to make a cash income was either to learn how to drive a bulldozer and go into little towns and drive a bulldozer during the day, and or alternatively, to trap Arctic fox and other animals and try to sell the pelts to the monopoly Hudson's Bay Company, which, of course, screwed the Inuit on the prices. So he came down to see my parents in the mid-50s and described this problem. And he said, is there a way that we could figure out how the Inuit can make some money by doing Inuit-type things rather than white man-type things? And my father looked up and he said, oh, hell yes, this is easy. We'll start a nonprofit corporation and we'll market the art in the American art market. And he and Jim Houston and I set up something that we called Eskimo Art Incorporated. That existed until my father passed away about 8 years ago, at which time my wife Kathy and I took a look, and Eskimo Art Incorporated had achieved its purpose. We shut it down. But by that point, the management and control of Inuit art in Baffin Island was entirely in the hands of the Inuit artists themselves, rather than having a whole bunch of what might be called colonialists trying to run the art for their own purposes. We thought we had to get it into the hands of the people who were doing the creative work. And actually, that's one of the things I'm the proudest of.
Let's see.
At this point, Phil Power showed me some of the prints hanging in the Center for Michigan, including one of an owl. Its main body is printed in black, but it graduates into a bright orange. Power said this represents the story of a man,
Ekyaktalaulavik, who had a wife and kids and was a wonderful hunter and a distinguished person in his community. And a big storm came in with a whiteout. And there was no food in the snow house. So he said, well, I got to go out and find something to eat. We can't keep my family going. And everybody said, well, you can't possibly do that. You'll never find your way back home. And he said, I got to do this. So he went out into the whiteout, into the storm. And sure enough, in about 3 minutes, he was lost and had no idea where he was. And then suddenly, in front of him, he looked up, and there was an owl. And the owl landed in front of him and said, you are Ekyaktalaulavik, right? And he said, yes, I am. And you are a famous and distinguished person. He said, nonsense, I'm a totally incompetent thing. And this went on and on and on the way Inuit people do. And finally, at the end of the conversation, the owl said, look, I know you're out, you're looking for food. Follow me, I'll take you to a seal breathing hole, and then I'll take you back to your snow house. And at that, the owl burst into flames, and the light from the burning owl led Ekyaktalaulavik to the seal hole and back to his snow house. And this print is called The Enchanted Owl for that reason.
The bulk of the sculptures are in Power's home.
Here's the collection.
The art display is kept in a room a lot like a comfortable museum itself.
This is caribou horn that's been incised.
Much of it is stone, some of it bone and ivory. You can find some photos of the pieces on the Michigan Radio website, michiganradio.org.
This collection ranges from pieces made in the 40s probably to the 70s. And that's a significant period of time because it's the period over which Inuit art evolved from its starting point, which is to say, how do we understand the soul of a seal by carving a seal, into a much more, how do we engage in artistic activity for its own purposes? And the span of this collection reflects that fundamental change in this art form.
The collection will be moved to the University of Michigan's Museum of Art about 1 year from now.
What have you asked the University of Michigan Museum of Art to do with this collection of statues and other art?
We have asked them not to engage in relatively standard academic activities, which would, under ordinary circumstances, entail hiring a curator and putting out scholarly monographs and other sorts of things. They'll do that, but that's not the main point. The main point is to find ways in which Inuit art can be brought to the attention of a very wide range of people in Michigan and around the world so that they can understand what Inuit people have to say and what they think about. So traveling shows going to schools. Bring an Inuit artist down from the high Arctic and have that person carve or make prints in the museum. And have Inuit people describe what it's like to build a snow house and to live in the high Arctic in the winter. So the idea is to provide all the benefits of travel to a very extreme place on the earth, but without having to take a plane and take a snow machine and to go out in 60 degree below cold.
That's Phil Power talking about the collection of Inuit art he and his wife Kathy are giving to the University of Michigan Museum of Art. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A Flint water researcher might have thrown a monkey wrench into a prosecutor's case against the director of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Nick Lyon is being prosecuted by the state on charges of involuntary manslaughter and misconduct. Another agency official is charged with obstruction of justice. A complaint by Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards challenges the veracity of the research of another Flint water researcher. Here to help us sort out what's happening is Michigan Radio Steve Carmody. Steve, first remind us, who is Mark Edwards?
Mark Edwards is from Virginia Tech. He is an expert on water, and he was the first researcher to come forward with evidence that Flint had elevated levels of lead in its drinking water.
He's questioning the validity of research into the cause and scope of bacteria in Flint water that causes Legionnaire's disease. And then he filed a complaint with Michigan's Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. What's the complaint and who's it against?
Well, the complaint is lodged against Sean McElmurray. He's a professor from Wayne State University, and he's led a group of researchers from Wayne State, Michigan State, other institutions into the presence of Legionella bacteria in Flint. And in a Legionnaire's disease outbreak in 2014 and 2015 that killed at least a dozen people and sickened about another 80 more. And he's looked into this, and his team have come up with the research that has pointed the finger of blame for the outbreak for at least most of the cases to the switch to the Flint River. That's where the Legionella bacteria got into the system, they claim, and that's what the source of many of the illnesses came from. And he has been a leading, basically a key witness for the prosecution against state officials, state health department officials, basically suggesting they were dragging their feet on this investigation into Legionella. And that at one point he said they did not want to know about additional cases of Legionella.
What's Mark Edwards' complaint?
Mark Edwards has issues with some of the research, some of the techniques that the McElmurray group has been using as part of its research. And in his complaint that he filed this month with the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, he accuses McElmurray of adopting ideas that were not his for government grant money and grants that he also allegedly overstated his own work in Flint to as part of that grant request. And one thing that Edwards says is that for him, it's becoming more and more apparent that Dr. McElmurray seems to be in a habit of making false statements that benefit Dr. McElmurray's career. That was something that Edwards posted this week.
So the state of Michigan is investigating that complaint. What does this all mean to Attorney General Bill Schuette's special prosecutor's case?
Well, we do have in Dr. Edwards and Dr. McElmurray, two of the more prominent researchers who have been involved in looking into the Flint water crisis. And Dr. McElmurray is a key witness for the prosecution in the criminal proceedings into the water crisis. And Dr. Edwards has been a critic of Dr. McElmurray's work and has been earlier this week was on the stand as a defense witness criticizing that work in particular and saying that instead of pointing the finger at the officials from the Department of Health, that the real people responsible for this are the ones who worked in the Department of Environmental Quality.
That's Steve Carmody with Michigan Radio. Hey, thanks, Steve.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's turn to Wayne State University law professor and former federal prosecutor Peter Henning. It sounds as though this complaint by Mark Edwards puts a big question mark in the attorney general's case, since it depends on Sean McElmurray's research. If you were prosecuting a case like this, what would be going through your mind right now?
Well, certainly I'd be concerned about whether this complaint has any basis. So step number one as a prosecutor is to get information from Dr. McElmurray to ensure that there's nothing out there that could undermine his credibility, because a lot in this case depends on his scientific findings. So as a prosecutor, I want to ensure that he can go up on the witness stand and not have his credibility undermined.
In that case, do you wait for the regulatory agency which is investigating this, or do you just do your own research?
I think the prosecutor has to do his or her own research. Whatever the regulatory agency decides could be important, but that could be months away. And, of course, this case is moving forward, and indeed there should be a decision soon from the court as to whether to bind over the defendants. So as a prosecutor, I have to take active steps to ensure that one of my key witnesses and his reports are unassailable.
If the agency finds some kind of misdeed after the trials are over, would that be an automatic reason for appeal?
Not necessarily. It certainly would be grounds for an appeal, but this case is really in many ways about the expert testimony. So it's going to depend on how the prosecutors present that, and is this going to be persuasive first to the judge in deciding to bind it over, and then if it goes to trial, to the jury. So it could have an effect, although it wouldn't necessarily lead to the reversal of a conviction if, in fact, there is a conviction.
And final question is about personalities. I mean, the community of Flint has a lot of confidence in Mark Edwards. He's considered one of the heroes in getting the truth out about Flint water contamination. Is that important or something you'd weigh as a prosecutor in designing your strategy?
It's something I would at least take into consideration, but the focus now is what evidence can be presented in court, and do I as a prosecutor have a credible witness who is going to be subject to cross-examination, and that's expected in any trial that your witness is going to be examined and credibility attacked, but how strong an attack will there be? So I think the focus is much more narrow at the moment on, can this witness, Dr. McElmurray, can he be an effective witness at trial?
Peter Henning is a law professor at Wayne State University. Thanks very much, sir.
Thank you.
Sean McElmurray put out a response statement. It reads in part, quote, "I have been working as part of a multidisciplinary team of experts comprised of colleagues from the University of Michigan, Michigan State University, Kettering University, Colorado State University, and Henry Ford Health System. Our work has been peer-reviewed and accepted for publication in some of the most prestigious scientific journals in the nation. I stand by the quality of our science and the integrity of our work in Flint and deny the allegations recently raised. The claims made against our group are false, and they are examples of unprofessional and destructive conduct." End quote. A new analysis of heat wave patterns published in the peer-reviewed Nature Climate Change could mean changes in the Great Lakes region as soon as 15 years from now. Here to explain this climate change is the lead author of that study, Josme Lopez. You found human-caused greenhouse gases will have more influence on heat waves than natural variability. What kind of differences might we see in the Great Lakes region?
Thank you, Lester, for the opportunity to talk to your audience. Yes, this study found that about 15 years from now, climate change, human-induced climate change, will be the dominant driver of heat wave occurrence over the Great Lake regions, topping natural variability. Several things that are new in this article is, one, we identify the most common heat wave patterns over the U.S., and the Great Lake pattern is one of the most common, and also this pattern, heat wave pattern, influenced the largest population over the U.S. About 70 million people live underneath this heat wave pattern over the Great Lakes. And what we found is human-induced climate change will be responsible for most of the heat waves past the 2030s. so which is about 15 years from now.
When you say climate change will cause these heat waves, are we talking about more of them, longer heat waves, hotter heat waves? What should we expect?
We're talking about more of them, hotter, and also longer lasting. I want to mention that they are the number one weather-related cause of death in the U.S. So heat waves are very serious, and you have to keep in mind that these are anomalies on top of your daily summer mean temperature. And this daily mean summer temperature is also on the rise due to human-induced global warming. So these heat waves will be on top of the already warming planet.
Now, as you pointed out, heat waves already cause more weather-related deaths than tornadoes or hurricanes.
Yes.
How bad could this get?
Oh, it's going to get worse because you have to also account for other factors, the human factors. One, population growth. We tend to grow, and also we tend to condense ourselves into cities. And you have the city island effect as well.
Right, the heat island, yeah.
And also, you have another fact that the population is aging. As we move on into the future, you can see an aging trend. And heat waves is responsible for less of death, but especially on the elder. So we believe that population growth coupled to the fact that heat waves are becoming more extreme will lead to more deaths.
What kind of changes on the ground might occur?
The Great Lakes is a very special region. You have huge bodies of water. And when you have a warming air, that tends to actually evaporate more water from the lake. And also that's coupled to a temperature increase, also humidity increase. And that's why you end up with a higher heat index, which is very familiar in the weather community. And that's why you get from your forecast how hot is it going to be and what we will actually feel like. So when you have a hotter air temperature and also increase humidity, that's going to put more stress on a human body because we cool down by sweating. And this sweat has to evaporate to the surrounding air. But if the surrounding air is warmer and also more humid, this mechanism, natural mechanism for a human body to cool down, actually becomes less efficient. I want to point out as well that precipitation is also an important factor that's not been talked in this paper, but it's linked to heat waves, and I know for the Great Lakes, it's very important for the lake levels. If you have a drop in lake levels, economically you will lose a lot because the amount of cargo that ships can actually transport in the Great Lakes decreases by a lot when you have a lower lake. Also, when you have warmer temperatures, it kind of creates a warm water over the top of the lake compared to the depth. So it creates what's known as hypoxia, which actually decreases the oxygen level in the Great Lakes and has a tremendous impact on fisheries as well.
So I'd heard earlier models had predicted that the upper Midwest might actually see more precipitation. This one's saying that's probably not the case because of these heat waves.
The upper Midwest will see more precipitation, but you will have a lot more evaporation due to the warmer air. So you have a warmer temperature, the air will feel the need to have more moisture. It's going to draw the moisture from large bodies of water, such as the Great Lakes.
Your study predicts these heat waves will start hitting the western United States even earlier than the Great Lakes region. There are parts of the West that are already struggling with wildfires and water shortages, but we get a lot of produce from places like California. What will these heat waves do to the food supply?
That's a great question. The West region, unfortunately, is the first one that's going to see this effect of climate change on heat waves, but not only on heat waves. These events are also tied to droughts. So drought is kind of like a necessary condition for a heat wave to occur, especially in the western part of the country. And what we found in this study is that the climate change signal is already emerging. We can see it in our data at present. We see that some of the heat extremes that are occurring on the west and drought are already due to human-induced climate change. And California is one of the most important regions for food supply for the entire country. And I'm sure there's going to be lots of impact because of water shortage associated with droughts and heat waves.
I'm sure you've heard this before, but people say, you know, the weather forecasters can't even determine what the weather is going to be like tomorrow. How are they figuring out what's happening in 15 years? How do you know your climate models are accurate?
These climate models we use, this is the latest, the state of the art. We actually don't call them climate models anymore. We call them air system models because they incorporate all sort of processes. They incorporate everything we know about the Earth system as a whole. They include land models, they include sea ice, they include land ice, they include land processes, biochemistry processes, all sort of things. And we actually, before we project into the future, we test these models with present data, with what we have observed. And these models, at least for heat waves, are very accurate. When we define the heat wave cluster, the most common patterns of heat wave over the U.S., the models are able to reproduce this common heat wave pattern that we actually observe. And also, this is a great question. That's the reason why we use many models. For this study, we use over 15 models, and they tend to have some biases, some errors one way, or other models has errors another way. And we believe by averaging all these models, we filter out most of the errors as well.
Jose Lopez is a meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's the lead author of a new analysis that was published in Nature Climate Change that says the Great Lakes region might see more and longer heat waves as soon as 15 years from now. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. You sound horrible.
Yeah, I did a really stupid thing.
Yeah?
I told my friends, it's been great. I haven't gotten sick all year.
And now you are.
Now I have a cold.
I hope I don't catch it. Well, you've got a cure-all here, it looks like.
Exactly. This is Tammy's cure-all.
It's not NyQuil, so that's good.
Right. So usually when I'm sick like this, I would turn to a hot toddy. But we've done a lot of hot toddies this season already because it was so darn cold. So instead, I thought, I'm just going to take all the things that they tell you are good for you when you have a cold and put them into a drink together.
So like some of the elements of a hot toddy, but in a different kind of drink.
A little bit, right? So I started off with orange juice, right? Got to drink lots of orange juice when you're sick. So I used some blood oranges because they're in season right now, and I love that. And I muddled them, like a big slice of blood orange, and I muddled it in a shaker along with some ginger because ginger is really good for your immune system, or so I've heard. Plus, I just think it tastes delicious. So I muddled that up, and then I added some lemon juice, some honey for a sore throat. This is a smash, and smashes can take all different kinds of spirits, but we recently got that freshwater rum from New Holland, and I've been really liking to mix with that, so I decided that that's what I would put in here, so I put 2 ounces of the rum in.
What kind of rum is that?
It's a barrel-aged rum, so they age it in several different kinds of barrels, new oak barrels, wine barrels. I've really enjoyed this rum. It's quite nuanced for a Michigan rum.
So what do you call this drink?
Tammy's cure-all.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
So I used 2 slices of ginger, 1 big slice of blood orange that I cut into pieces to make it easier to muddle, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of a honey syrup, which was honey mixed with a little bit of water to loosen it up, and then 2 ounces of the rum. But just like any smash, you can totally adjust this to your own flavor preferences. More citrus, less citrus, more sweet, less sweet, whatever you like.
So because it has citrus in it, you shook it instead of stirred it.
That's right. So I muddled it all up in my shaker, then I shook it, strained it onto a rocks glass, and added some ice cubes. And you could use a fine strainer to get the orange pulp out, but I thought it would be healthier if I left it in.
So I got 2 questions. Does it taste good? And do you feel better?
Well, you should taste it first because I don't want to make you sick. So you'll have to answer that question.
All right, let me see. Oh, it's delicious. It's tart, but really nice. I like it.
All right, I'm going to try it now. I'm cured. I feel so much better.
Well, we'll debate the restorative properties, but it certainly is a good drink. So Tammy's cure-all for whatever ails you.
Cheers.
That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Rusty, where's my cocktail?